it's going the way of all pieces of machinery. It has been decided that they will be phased out in the naval service, and we will not see any more SPADs flying in the United States Navy.
On April 13, 1968, the United States Navy officially ended its use of a small but courageous propeller-driven aircraft, affectionately known as the SPAD. Before the end came for these workhorses of Korea and Vietnam, we talked with a man who won't soon forget the SPADs, Commander Hank Bailey of Lemoore, California, commanding officer of Attack Squadron 115. He described the work his squadron was doing in the Navy's Vietnam War effort.
Our missions out here are primarily in the north. We are search and rescue aircraft. We escort the helicopters and the seaplanes that do the pickup of the pilot, protect them either from hostile boats, hostile aircraft, or firing from the beach if the incident happens to be close enough to the beach. Secondly, we have a going mission called Sea Dragon, which is the spotting for the naval gunfire firing at the coastline of North Vietnam. The gun control people and the aircraft in the air, usually one section of two, are on the same radio frequency, and simply said, we just tell the destroyer exactly where his shot falls on the beach, and then he makes the corresponding corrections in his gunfire control system, putting the next one, if it works perfectly, right on the target. Our typical flight in the day runs 4 7/10 hours. Typical jet cycle is 1.5 hours. Therefore, we can much more efficiently cover those missions which take a great amount of time to develop.
The SPAD will be hard to replace. As a matter of fact, it will take a combination of jet aircraft and helicopters to continue their mission. But Commander Bailey has his memories. He recalls a spotting mission he participated in with two destroyers, the HMAS Hobart of the Australian Navy and the American destroyer USS Sumner.
We were firing at a target that was about 3 miles inland, and I was very close to the beach line spotting this target. When coastal defense guns right on the coastline opened up against the destroyers, and AAA batteries also at the same time opened up against the two spotting aircraft. Shots from the coastal defense guns at first were finding their range, but eventually they did find the range and were dropping the mortar shells in and around the destroyers as close as 10 yards. Salt spray raised from the splashes came right up on the ship and shrapnel. While the ships were running in a sinuous course away from them, the two aircraft rolled in and made some 13 runs against the coastal defense sites and the AAA batteries, finally silencing them then. And neither the aircraft nor the two destroyers were harmed in the slightest. And this day, we were fortunate in the fact that the HMS Hobart had a 5-inch 54 gun, which shoots further than the coastal defense site. So once she had gotten out beyond the range, she turned around, paralleled the coast, and then I went back in, and for the next 55 minutes, we proceeded to blow up quite a few of the coastal defense sites.
This program was produced at the headquarters of the Commander-in-Chief United States Pacific Fleet and was presented as a public service of this station. Navy journalist Niels and Ross speaking.
Grab a gun and shoot them before they shoot me.
I didn't even know I'd gotten hit until after we'd stopped the boat. I looked down and saw the blood running.
The Navy's heavily armed, fiberglass-hulled river patrol boats, or PBRs, patrol the maze of rivers and canals in the Mekong Delta of South Vietnam. They patrol in pairs for 12 hours at a stretch, scanning the thick jungle growth ashore for an elusive enemy that can strike at almost any moment. This is the story of two young Navy men who ride the PBRs and their first encounter with the Viet Cong. Navy Engineman Third Class Joe Williams of Long Beach, California, was in the lead boat. It had been a routine patrol. Then suddenly, from the shoreline, a Viet Cong ambush.
The first round hit back aft, 57 or 75 millimeter recoilless. The after gunner was hit. He caught almost the full blast. It tore about a good 5-inch hole in the side of the boat and split the seam all the way down, and it was taking on water. The second round hit, and it threw a little bit of shrapnel on my leg, and I jumped up on the 60 and started shooting it.
Navy Engineman Third Class James Plaster of Springfield, Missouri, was aboard the second PBR 200 yards to the rear.
I seen her boat catch first round, big puff of smoke come out of it. So I jumped on the M60, and I could get trained on a beach where they were getting fire, and I fired maybe 100 rounds. And a patrol officer told me to come up and take the wheel. And the other guy took the M60 that I was on. About another 30, 45 seconds, we took our first round right behind the coxswain's flat. All I got was 8 or 9 pieces of shrapnel on my leg. Two other guys back aft got a little shrapnel out of that round. It tore about a 5 or 6 inch hole inside the boat. Then about the next 30, 45 seconds, we took 6 more rounds, which knocked out the engines. 2 after gunners on the boat were knocked out. They couldn't shoot. The forward gunner was still firing at this time. He hadn't got hit at all. I'd say we wasn't over 75 yards from the beach. We were receiving fire all the time. So the patrol officer told us to leave the boat.
There was only one experienced swimmer aboard Plaster's boat and 2 wounded. But they managed to struggle ashore. Eluding the Viet Cong, they were picked up by a Navy Seawolf helicopter operating in the area. Meanwhile, aboard the lead boat, the first Viet Cong round had wounded the after gunner.
The coxswain grabbed the radio and called back to our lead boat. We're hit, recoilless. He immediately pushed the throttles all the way down. And it was right after that we took another round right in the water alongside the boat. And that's the one that got him. And it got him in both of his legs. And so he couldn't hardly stand up with that, but he was holding onto the steering wheel to hold him up to drive the boat. And the only thing I could think of was get him patched up. I grabbed the first aid kit. I didn't know what I was doing. I just had to get the bleeding stopped. That's all I could get in my head. We had radio contact with our main base, and they told us clear the area and go to Bentray, which was just a little ways away. I got some shrapnel in the right leg and in the right arm, so I patched that up.
They arrived at Ben Tray, and the wounded were offloaded.
The forward gunner hadn't gotten hit at all, and the forward gunner and I wanted to go back in, but they wouldn't let us. And just about this time, we could see other PBRs coming up into the canal to go in to try and pull the other one out.
Their baptism of fire was over. It hadn't ended happily, but they'd learned from it. Next time, they'd be ready.
After you've been in one like that there, you know what to do. You know when to do it. You know how to react. You're not near as shook up as you was on the first one. I'm 20 now.
I'm 21 now. I was 20 at the time.
This program was produced at the headquarters of the Commander-in-Chief of the United States Pacific Fleet and was a public service presentation of this station. Navy journalist Nielsen Ross speaking.
Survival, really. Briefing is survival. You've got to know everything the other man intends to do during the period that you're going to be in the air. If you don't, you're really in trouble.
Before a pilot is launched from the flight deck of one of the Navy's giant aircraft carriers, he must undergo a process known as a briefing. Not very glamorous, and to the uninitiated, an endless stream of facts, figures, data, and descriptions. The briefing, nonetheless, is as essential to a Navy pilot as his survival gear. Commander Paul Gilchrist of Freeport, New York, commanding officer of Fighter Squadron 53 aboard the 7th Fleet carrier Hancock, describes a typical pilot briefing.
Well, a briefing consists of two portions. One is what we call the air intelligence briefing. This is a single briefing given to all the pilots who are going to be launched at that particular launch time from the carrier. It doesn't matter if they go on different missions even. They get all the general information which is necessary for to carry out a strike at that particular hour of the day. It includes weather, what they call the air order of battle, what kind of enemy forces they can expect to meet in the air, what kind of enemy forces they can expect to meet on the ground, the general search and rescue situation, recent incidents which could be of interest to them, surface operations of our own Navy, just a general briefing which might last 30 to 40 minutes, consists of what I call the air intelligence briefing. Then the second part of the briefing begins, which is the meat of the brief. And this is conducted right in the ready room between the pilots on a particular flight. They have to know from moment to moment everything that the other pilots are going to do throughout the entire hour and 45 minutes of the flight. They have to know the switch procedure for the ordnance they're carrying. They have to know what kind of tactics they intend to use in the event that they meet air opposition. They have to pre-plan their tactics in the event of flak that's heavy. They have to pre-plan their tactics in the event one of them is hit. They have to pre-plan everything that could conceivably happen on the hop that might be impossible to discuss on the radio. I call that the meat of the brief because this is the most important part. This is what enables pilots to work as a team and to survive under a situation out here which is fraught with risk.
Though oftentimes briefings seem repetitive, the attention of the Navy pilot seldom wavers. A seemingly insignificant point covered in a briefing might make the difference between life and death. Commander Gilchrist recalls one briefing which did.
Every brief that we conduct, we have an emergency of the day. This may sound silly, but there are so many things that can go wrong in a flight, whether it be something that happens to your own airplane not involved in enemy fire, or it could be something which could be the result of actual combat operations. So this particular brief happened to be a loss of a radio at night, and a resultant loss of a power control system in the airplane. That happened to be the plan of the briefing for the day. All pilots conducted it. I did on this particular hop with my wingman, and this is exactly what happened. Lost radio and we lost power control systems, and I felt that had we not gone over in minute detail everything that would be required of the leader and of the wingman incidentally had the failure, we might very well not have gotten him back on board. As it turned out, everything went just like clockwork, just the way it is supposed to happen, and we got him back on board. No particular problem.
This program was produced at the headquarters of the Commander-in-Chief United States Pacific Fleet and was presented as a public service of this station. Navy journalist Niels and Ross speaking.
The patrol officer had been hurt real bad, and the engineman had been hurt, and both of them jumped over the side and swam to the beach. I couldn't see any. I thought I was the only one left alive.
Navy Petty Officer Jack Anderson of Blanchard, Oklahoma, is a forward gunner aboard one of the Navy's River Patrol Boats, or PBRs. Operating in the Mekong Delta of South Vietnam, it's the job of the PBRs to interdict Viet Cong traffic of men and materials in the rivers and canals. On a recent mission, Anderson's boat, in company with another PBR, spotted a concentration of VC bunkers along the shoreline of a small canal. They decided to try and destroy as many as they could. This was no simple task.
People get the bunkers from these war pictures they see on TV as a structure where people go into and where they fight. But a bunker over here, its main purpose can be a water dike in the rice paddies. It can serve as a bunker. They take the mud out of the river, off the riverbanks, and pack it in, sometimes 4 and 5 feet thick. When the mud hardens, it's just like concrete. I was sitting in the gun tub, and I heard, I guess it was a Viet Cong squad leader. He yelled, and in that time, they shot a rocket at us. I thought at first maybe one of the rockets that we were shooting had ricocheted off the bunker and hit out in front of us. But there were two rockets hit in front of me. These here just hit the water and exploded. One of our tactics is as soon as we're ambushed, beat it up the river, back the way we come to get away, and then take on tactics from there, which is about all you can do in an ambush situation. We took several hits, bullet holes in the boat. We went about 300 yards up the canal, and we were afraid to go any further because we knew that was all Charlie country there. And so we didn't want to go up there any farther than we had to.
The PBRs called in a strike of Navy Seawolf helicopters operating in the area to soften up the enemy position.
The Seawolves come in, and they made about two runs, and they came back and come over us, and we made our run out. I was on the after gun on the second firing run, and we took a direct hit from a rocket in a coxswain's flat. That killed the boat captain and the forward gunner. Found out that later there were three of us that were still alive. But I thought I was the only one out of the whole patrol that was alive because I couldn't see anybody else. The smoke was so thick, I couldn't see the cover boat, and I couldn't see the patrol officer or the engineman. So I went to the coxswain's flat, and it was on fire, and our gas tanks were on fire. And then we took another hit. It was about 3 feet to my left. I went into the coxswain's flat, and there were this fire and the smoke, and I couldn't see, and I didn't know where we was going. I could just only use my senses, you know, before I thought we were, and how close I thought we were to the bank. I drove the boat out, steered it out to the main channel, and then I couldn't stand any longer because of the heat. And while I'm in the coxswain's flat, we take another hit in the bow, another rocket hit in the bow. And we were receiving heavy automatic fire and rocket fire from both banks. We was in a crossfire position. And then we were back practically on the beach again, and so I went up to drive the boat out again to point it back out, and it wouldn't react. The steering wheel had melted. It had melted off on the inside and had burned off, and the whole boat was consumed in flames practically. The boat beached, and it started to list, and I thought it was turning over. So I jumped over the side and swam to the middle of the canal, and there were VC on both sides were running up and down the banks shooting at me, and I was trying to swim, going under. And a sea wolf come up and made a pass over me, and I saw the cover boat coming through the smoke. I was exhausted and hurt, and I didn't know how long I'd be able to stay up. And one of the guys jumped off of the boat and pulled me over to the line. They finally got me up on the boat. They were still banging away at us, and we were banging back, but we made it out okay with that anymore. Any more casualties.
The two crewmen from Anderson's boat had gone over the side at the beginning of the action, and although both were wounded, they made it to shore, where they were picked up by the second PBR. For the heroism he displayed under fire, Jack Anderson was decorated.
I got a Bronze Star for it. I hope I don't have to do anything like that again.
This program was produced at the headquarters of the Commander-in-Chief of the United States Pacific Fleet and was a public service presentation of this station. Navy journalist Nielsen Ross speaking.
Here, and the air boss said he'd have a ready deck for us at 45. We figured it'd take 9 minutes to get the first one here, so we started the first one down at 36 minutes after the hour. He was ready for us just about the time the first aircraft was a mile and a half out.
Night and day, the Navy launches strikes against North Vietnam from the decks of 7th Fleet carriers stationed in the Gulf of Tonkin. Every bit as important as the launch is the recovery. Landing on an aircraft carrier in perfect weather is a complicated process at best. But at night, or when the weather is bad, the Navy must rely on the precise skill and teamwork of men like Air Control Chief Harry Trumbull of Hanford, California, a Navy career man whose job consists of supervising an operation known as carrier-controlled approach.
We give them what we call glide path information. We tell them if they descend too fast or they descend too slow, that they won't stay on the glide path. So we tell them if they're going below or above, and then they'll adjust their descent according to what we tell them. Normally, we'll start about 35 miles. They'll come in, come back off their missions, and we'll assign them different altitudes and a certain holding point. And they'll hold there, and we'll give them a time to start down. And this time it's predicated on what time the deck will be ready to receive them. Depending on what distance they start from and whether the ship is steaming into them or away from them, we know how many minutes it takes them to get from Marshall to the ramp. So we'll start them down so they'll be there when the air boss tells us that he's ready to receive them. When we first start out, we have a long-distance radar. Also, it has the IFF, so we can tell our aircraft from the other aircraft in the area. This radar we use until we can get them down to about 5,000 feet. Then we switch to what we call our low-altitude intermediate radar. This radar is quite a bit more accurate in azimuth lineup. This one we use to vector them into our precision radar. And then once we get them on our precision radar, they're controlled on this radar to the ramp. Now, should they wave off or boulder, then they're picked up again on the low altitude radar and vectored back in, and they're sequenced back into the pattern for another approach. Our precision radar accuracy is a plus or minus 20 feet. In other words, if our target shows that he is right on the center line, he's within 20 feet either side. When he reaches a mile or three quarters of a mile, then he picks up what we call the ball. And this is an electronic aid that's back on the fantail. The pilot has a visual indication of his lineup, and he'll switch from radar control to this about the last half or three quarters of a mile, and the LSO will also, he has him in visual sight, and he helps him with his lineup.
The terrific rate of speed of the modern Navy jets makes Chief Trumbull's job all the more complicated. For instance, a jet which is a mile and a half away from the carrier is in reality only seconds away from the flight deck.
They'll go about 2 miles in 1 minute, so he'd be about three quarters of a minute out.
A large number of aircraft traveling at terrific speed in a very limited area. One mistake by the Navy men conducting the carrier-controlled approach could mean certain death for a pilot.
We always hope we don't make this mistake, and so far we haven't. This is our second cruise. I've got a bunch of real professionals here, real good men. Like I say, we hope we never make this mistake.
This program was produced at the headquarters of the Commander-in-Chief United States Pacific Fleet and was presented as a public service of this station. Navy journalist Nielsen Ross speaking.